whether he had filmmaking chops, but also if he could work well with others. The first sign of trouble? The film he delivered clocked in at 12 minutes, more of a medium than a short. But length is flexible. The real problem was that although the director was extraordinarily creative, he was unable to settle on a spine for a story. The piece meandered, lacked focus, and thus packed no emotional punch. It wouldn't be the first time we would find someone who was able to invent wildly creative elements, but was unable to solve the problems of story, the central and most important creative challenge. So we pulled the plug. Some might have lost sleep over the $2 million we expended on this experiment, but we consider it money well spent. As Joe Rant said at the time, better to have train wrecks with miniature trains than with real ones. 6. Learning to See. In the year after Toy Story's release, we introduced a 10-week program to teach every new hire how to use our proprietary software. We called this program Pixar University, and I hired a first-rate technical trainer to run it. At that point, the moniker University was a little misleading, though, as this was more of a training seminar than anything resembling an institution of higher learning. It is easy to justify a training program, but I had another agenda, and in trying to accomplish it, we would find surprising bonuses. While some people at Pixar already knew how to draw, and beautifully, the majority of our employees were not artists. But there was an important principle that underlies the process of learning to draw, and we wanted everyone to understand it. So I hired Elise Kleidman, who had taught drawing workshops inspired by the 1979 book Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain by Betty Edwards, to come in and teach us how to heighten our powers of observation. In those days, you'd often hear about the concepts of left and right brain thinking, later called L mode and R mode. The L mode was verbal, analytic. R mode was visual, perceptual. Elise taught us that while many activities used both L mode and R mode, drawing required shutting the L mode off. This amounted to learning to suppress that part of your brain that jumps to conclusions, seeing an image as only an image and not as an object. Think about what happens when we try to draw a face. Most of us sketch out the nose, eyes, forehead, ears, and mouth, but unless we've learned to draw formally, they're terribly out of proportion. They don't resemble anybody in particular. That's because, to the brain, all parts of the face are not created equal. For example, since the eyes and mouth, the loci of communication, are more important to us than foreheads, more emphasis is put on recognizing them, and when we draw them, we tend to draw them too large while the forehead is drawn too small. We don't draw a face as it is. Rather, we draw it as our models say it is. The models of three-dimensional objects that we carry in our heads have to be general. They must represent all variations of the given objects. Our mental model of a shoe, for example, must encompass everything from a stiletto heel to a steel-toed boot. It can't be so specific that it excludes those extremes. Our brain's ability to generalize is an essential tool, but some people are able to move from the general to the specific to see more clearly. To stay with our drawing example, some people draw better than others. What are they doing that most of us aren't? And if the answer is that they are setting aside their preconceptions, can we all learn to do that? In most cases, the answer is yes. Art teachers use a few different tricks to train new artists. They place an object upside down, for example, so that each student can look at it as a pure shape and not as a familiar, recognizable thing, a shoe, say. The brain does not distort this upside-down object, because it doesn't automatically impose its model of issue upon it. Another trick is to ask students to focus on negative spaces, the areas of space around an object that are not the object itself. For instance, in drawing a chair, the new artist might draw it poorly because she knows what a chair is supposed to look like, and that chair in her head, her mental model, keeps her from reproducing precisely what she sees in front of her. However, if she is asked to draw what is not the chair, the spaces between the chair legs, for example, then the proportions are easier to get right, and the chair itself will look more realistic. The reason is that while the brain recognizes a chair as a chair, it assigns no meaning to the shape of the spaces between the chair's legs, and thus doesn't try to correct it to make it match the artist's mental model. The lesson is intended to help students to see shapes as they are, to ignore that part of the brain that wants to turn what is seen into a general notion, a model of the chair. A trained artist who sees a chair, then, is able to capture what the eye perceives, shape, color, before their recognizer function tells them what it is supposed to be. The same thing is true with color. When we look at a body of water, our brains think, and thus see, blue. If we're asked to paint a picture of a lake, we pick the color blue, and then we're surprised that it doesn't look right on the canvas. But if we look at different points in that same lake through a pinhole, thus divorcing it from the overall idea of lake, we see what is actually there: green and yellow and black and flashes of white. We don't let the brain fill in. Instead, we see the color as it really is. I want to add an important side note. That artists have learned to employ these ways of seeing does not mean they don't also see what we see. They do. They just see more because they've learned how to turn off their mind's tendency to jump to conclusions. They've added some observational skills to their toolboxes. This is why it is so frustrating that funding for arts programs in schools has been decimated, and those cuts stem from a fundamental misconception that art classes are about learning to draw. In fact, they are about learning to see. Whether or not you ever pick up a sketch pad or dream of being an animator, I hope you understand how it is possible with practice to teach your brain to observe something clearly without letting your preconceptions kick in. It is a fact of life, though a confounding one, that focusing on something can make it more difficult to see. The goal is to learn to suspend, if only temporarily, the habits and impulses that obscure your vision. I did not introduce this topic to convince you that anyone can learn to draw. The real point is that you can learn to set aside preconceptions. It isn't that you don't have biases, more that there are ways of learning to ignore them while considering a problem. Drawing the unchair can be a sort of metaphor for increasing perceptivity. Just as looking at what is not the chair helps bring it into relief, pulling focus away from a particular problem and instead looking at the environment around it can lead to better solutions. When we give notes on Pixar movies and isolate a scene, say, that isn't working, we have learned that fixing that scene usually requires making changes somewhere else in the film, and that is where our attention should go. Our filmmakers have become skilled at not getting caught up in a problem, but instead looking elsewhere in the story for solutions. Likewise, at Disney, the conflict between production and the oversight group could have been addressed by insisting that everyone behave better, when in fact the real solution came from questioning the premise on which the oversight group was formed. It was the setup, the preconceptions that preceded the problem, that needed to be faced. 7. Postmortems. The phases we go through while making a movie, conception, protection, developmental planning, and production, unfold over a period of years. When the release date finally rolls around, everyone is ready to move on to something new. But we are not done yet. At Pixar, there is one more essential phase of the process, the post-mortem. A post-mortem is a meeting held shortly after the completion of every movie in which we explore what did and didn't work and attempt to consolidate lessons learned. Companies, like individuals, do not become exceptional by believing they are exceptional, but by understanding the ways in which they aren't exceptional. Postmortems are one route into that understanding. Our first postmortem was held in Tiburon, California in 1998, a few weeks after we'd finished A Bug's Life. We had made all of two films at that point and were hyper-aware of how much we still had to learn. To keep anyone from going on too long, we had a 15-minute limit. Someone brought in a kitchen timer in the shape of a rooster. Here we were, talking about some of the most high-tech animation ever done, and we were managing the process with an old kitchen utensil. This postmortem, which took an entire day, delved into all aspects of the production. There was no aha moment, no epiphany that would turn our processes inside out. Instead, it's the spirit of the meeting that I remember most. Everyone was so engaged in rethinking the way we did things, so open to challenging long-held ideas and learning from the errors we'd made. No one was defensive. Everyone was proud, not only of the film, but of how committed we were to the culture from which the film had sprung. Afterward, we decided we should do this kind of deep analysis after every movie. Achieving that same level of insight in subsequent postmortems, however, proved elusive. Over the years, some were profound, and others were a complete waste of time. Sometimes people showed up but pulled their punches. I understood that this was human nature. Why poke a sleeping bear when you can just as easily move on to another campsite? In truth, to most people, postmortems seem a bit like having to swallow some kind of bad-tasting medicine. They know it's necessary, but they don't like it one bit. This was another puzzle for us. What was it that made some postmortems so bad, while others had a great outcome? Given that we all agree in principle that postmortems are good for us, I'm always struck by how much people dread them. Most feel that they've learned what they could during the execution of the project, so they'd just as soon move on. Problems that arose are frequently personal, so most are eager to avoid revisiting them. Who looks forward to a forum for being second-guessed? People in general would rather talk about what went right than what went wrong, using the occasion to give additional kudos to their most deserving team members. Left to our own devices, we avoid unpleasantness. It isn't just postmortems, though. In general, people are resistant to self-assessment. Companies are bad at it, too. Looking inward to them often boils down to this. We are successful, so what we are doing must be correct. Or the converse, we failed, so what we did was wrong. This is shallow. Do not be cowed into missing this opportunity. There are five reasons, I believe, to do postmortems. The first two are fairly obvious. The next three, less so. Consolidate what's been learned. While it is true that you learn the most in the midst of a project, the lessons are not generally coherent. Any individual can have a great insight, but may not have the time to pass it on. A process might be flawed, but you don't have time to fix it under the current schedule. Sitting down afterward is a way of consolidating all that you've learned, before you forget it. Postmortems are a rare opportunity to do analysis that simply wasn't possible in the heat of the project. teach others who weren't there. Even if everyone involved in a production understands what it taught them, the postmortem is a great way of passing on the positive and negative lessons to other people who were not on the project. So much of what we do is not obvious, the result of hard-won experience. Then again, some of what we do doesn't really make sense. The postmortem provides a forum for others to learn or challenge the logic behind certain decisions. Don't let resentments fester. Many things that go wrong are caused by misunderstandings or screw-ups. These lead to resentments that, if left unaddressed, can fester for years. But if people are given a forum in which to express their frustrations about the screw-ups in a respectful manner, then they are better able to let them go and move on. I have seen many cases where hurt feelings lingered far after the project, feelings that would have been worked through much more easily if they had been expressed in a post-mortem. Use the schedule to force reflection. I favor principles that lead you to think. Post-mortems, but also other activities such as brain trust meetings and dailies, are all about getting people to think and evaluate. The time we spend getting ready for a post-mortem meeting is as valuable as the meeting itself. In other words, the scheduling of a post-mortem forces self-reflection. If a post-mortem is a chance to struggle openly with our problems, the pre-post-mortem sets the stage for a successful struggle. I would even say that 90% of the value is derived from the preparation leading up to the post-mortem. Pay it forward. In a postmortem, you can raise questions that should be asked on the next project. A good postmortem arms people with the right questions to ask going forward. We shouldn't expect to find the right answers, but if we can get people to frame the right questions, then we'll be ahead of the game. While I think the reasons for postmortems are compelling, I know that most people still resist them, so I want to share some techniques that can help managers get the most out of them. First of all, vary the way you conduct them. By definition, postmortems are supposed to be about lessons learned, so if you repeat the same format, you tend to uncover the same lessons, which isn't much help to anyone. Even if you come up with a format that works well in one instance, people will know what to expect the next time, and they will game the process. I've noticed what might be called a law of subverting successful approaches, by which I mean once you've hit on something that works, don't expect it to work again, because attendees will know how to manipulate it the second time around. So try mid-mortems or narrow the focus of your post-mortem to special topics. At Pixar, we have had groups give courses to others on their approaches. We have occasionally formed task forces to address problems that span several films. Our first task force dramatically altered the way we thought about scheduling. The second one was an utter fiasco. The third one led to a profound change at Pixar, which I'll discuss in the final chapter. Next, remain aware that no matter how much you urge them otherwise, your people will be afraid to be critical in such an overt manner. One technique I've used to soften the process is to ask everyone in the room to make two lists: the top five things that they would do again and the top five things that they wouldn't do again. People find it easier to be candid if they balance the negative with the positive, and a good facilitator can make it easier for that balance to be struck. Finally, make use of data. Because we're a creative organization, people tend to assume that much of what we do can't be measured or analyzed. That's wrong. Many of our processes involve activities and deliverables that can be quantified. We keep track of the rates at which things happen, how often something has to be reworked, how long something actually took versus how long we estimated it would take, whether a piece of work was completely finished or not when it was sent to another department, and so on. I like data because it is neutral. There are no value judgments, only facts. That allows people to discuss the issues raised by data less emotionally than they might an anecdotal experience. Lindsay Collins, one of our producers at Pixar, says that data can be nothing less than soothing. It was such a relief for me when I began in this job to be able to look at historical data and see the patterns, she says. It took what felt like a very nebulous process and allowed me to break it down and start to put a loose structure on it. Having introduced the subject of data, however, I want to be clear about both its power and its limits. The power lies in the analysis of what we know about the production process. We have data, for example, on the time spent building models and sets, animating and lighting them. This data, of course, only gives a narrow glimpse into what happened while the models and sets were being built and lit. But it gives us something to work with to reveal potential patterns, which can be used to feed discussions that help us improve. There are limits to data, however, and some people rely on it too heavily. Analyzing it correctly is difficult. And it is dangerous to assume that you always know what it means. It is very easy to find false patterns in data. Instead, I prefer to think of data as one way of seeing, one of many tools we can use to look for what's hidden. If we think data alone provides answers, then we have misapplied the tool. It is important to get this right. Some people swing to the extremes of either having no interest in the data or believing that the facts of measurement alone should drive our management. Either extreme can lead to false conclusions. You can't manage what you can't measure is a maxim that is taught and believed by many in both the business and education sectors. But in fact, the phrase is ridiculous. Something said by people who are unaware of how much is hidden. A large portion of what we manage can't be measured, and not realizing this has unintended consequences. The problem comes when people think that data paints a full picture, leading them to ignore what they can't see. Here's my approach. Measure what you can, evaluate what you measure, and appreciate that you cannot measure the vast majority of what you do. And at least once in a while, make time to take a step back and think about what you are doing. 8. Continuing to learn. I want to end this list by talking a little more about the founding of Pixar University and Elise Kleidman's mind-expanding drawing classes in particular. Those first classes were such a success. Of the 120 people who worked at Pixar then, 100 enrolled, that we gradually began expanding PU's curriculum. Sculpting, painting, acting, meditation, belly dancing, live-action filmmaking, computer programming, design and color theory, ballet. Over the years, we have offered free classes in all of them. This meant spending not only the time to find the best outside teachers, but also the real cost of freeing people up during their workday to take the classes. So what exactly was Pixar getting out of all of this? It wasn't that the class material directly enhanced our employees' job performance. Instead, there was something about an apprentice lighting technician sitting alongside an experienced animator who in turn was sitting next to someone who worked in legal or accounting or security, that proved immensely valuable. In the classroom setting, people interacted in a way they didn't in the workplace. They felt free to be goofy, relaxed, open, vulnerable. Hierarchy did not apply, and as a result, communication thrived. Simply by providing an excuse for us all to toil side by side, humbled by the challenge of sketching a self-portrait or writing computer code, or taming a lump of clay. PU changed the culture for the better. It taught everyone at Pixar, no matter their title, to respect the work that their colleagues did. And it made us all beginners again. Creativity involves missteps and imperfections. I wanted our people to get comfortable with that idea, that both the organization and its members should be willing at times to operate on the edge. I can understand that the leaders of many companies might wonder whether or not such classes would truly be useful, worth the expense. And I'll admit that these social interactions I described were an unexpected benefit. But the purpose of PU was never to turn programmers into artists or artists into belly dancers. Instead, it was to send a signal about how important it is for every one of us to keep learning new things. That, too, was a key part of remaining flexible, keeping our brains nimble by pushing ourselves to try things we haven't tried before. That's what PU lets our people do, and I believe it makes us stronger. We begin life as children being open to the ideas of others because we need to be open to learn. Most of what children encounter, after all, are things they've never seen before. The child has no choice but to embrace the new. If this openness is so wonderful, however, why do we lose it as we grow up? Where along the way do we turn from the wide-eyed child into the adult who fears surprises and has all the answers and seeks to control all outcomes? It puts me in mind of a night many years ago when I found myself at an art exhibit at my daughter's elementary school in Marin. As I walked up and down the hallways, looking at the paintings and sketches made by kids in grades K through 5, I noticed that the first and second graders' drawings looked better and fresher than those of the fifth graders. Somewhere along the line, the fifth graders had realized that their drawings did not look realistic, and they had become self-conscious and tentative. The result? Their drawings became more stilted and staid, less inventive, because they probably thought that others would recognize this fault. The fear of judgment was hindering creativity. If fear hinders us even in grade school, no wonder it takes such discipline. Some people even call it a practice, to turn off that inner critic in adulthood and return to a place of openness. In Korean Zen, the belief that it is good to branch out beyond what we already know is expressed in a phrase that means literally not know mind. To have a not know mind is a goal of creative people. It means you are open to the new, just as children are. Similarly, in Japanese Zen, that idea of not being constrained by what we already know is called beginner's mind. And people practice for years to recapture and keep a hold of it. When a new company is formed, its founders must have a startup mentality, a beginner's mind open to everything because, well, what do they have to lose? This is often something they later look back upon wistfully. But when that company becomes successful, its leaders often cast off that startup mentality because, they tell themselves, they have figured out what to do. They don't want to be beginners anymore. That may be human nature, but I believe it is a part of our nature that should be resisted. By resisting the beginner's mind, you make yourself more prone to repeat yourself than to create something new. The attempt to avoid failure, in other words, makes failure more likely. Paying attention to the present moment without letting your thoughts and ideas about the past and the future get in the way is essential. Why? Because it makes room for the views of others. It allows us to begin to trust them, and more important, to hear them. It makes us willing to experiment, and it makes it safe to try something that may fail. It encourages us to work on our awareness, trying to set up our own feedback loop in which paying attention improves our ability to pay attention. It requires us to understand that to advance creatively, we must let go of something. As the composer Philip Glass once said, "The real issue is not how do you find your voice, but getting rid of the damn thing." Chapter 11, The Unmade Future. Many of us have a romantic idea about how creativity happens. A lone visionary conceives of a film or a product in a flash of insight. Then that visionary leads a team of people through hardship to finally deliver on that great promise. The truth is, this isn't my experience at all. I've known many people I consider to be creative geniuses, and not just at Pixar and Disney, yet I can't remember a single one who could articulate exactly what this vision was that they were striving for when they started. In my experience, creative people discover and realize their visions over time and through dedicated, protracted struggle. In that way, creativity is more like a marathon than a sprint. You have to pace yourself. I'm often asked to predict what the future of computer animation will look like, and I try my best to come up with a thoughtful answer. But the fact is, just as our directors lack a clear picture of what their embryonic movies will grow up to be, I can't envision how our technical future will unfold, because it doesn't exist yet. As we forge ahead, while we imagine what might be, we must rely on our guiding principles, our intentions, and our goals, not on being able to see and react to what's coming before it happens. My old friend from the University of Utah, Alan Kay, Apple's chief scientist and the man who introduced me to Steve Jobs, expressed it well when he said, "The best way to predict the future is to invent it." This sounds like the kind of slogan you'd see on a bumper sticker, but it contains hidden depths. Invention, after all, is an active process that results from decisions we make. To change the world, we must bring new things into being. But how do we go about creating the unmade future? I believe that all we can do is foster the optimal conditions in which it, whatever it is, can emerge and flourish. This is where real confidence comes in. Not the confidence that we know exactly what to do at all times, but the confidence that together we will figure it out. That uncertainty can make us uncomfortable. We humans like to know where we are headed, but creativity demands that we travel paths that lead to who knows where. That requires us to step up to the boundary of what we know and what we don't know. While we all have the potential to be creative, some people hang back while others forge ahead. What are the tools they use that lead them toward the new? Those with superior talent and the ability to marshal the energies of others have learned from experience that there is a sweet spot between the known and the unknown where originality happens. The key is to be able to linger there without panicking. And that, according to the people who make films at Pixar and Disney Animation, means developing a mental model that sustains you. It might sound silly or woo-woo, this kind of visualization, but I believe it's crucial. Sometimes, especially at the beginning of a daunting project, our mental models are all we've got. For example, one of our producers, John Walker, stays calm by imagining his very taxing job as holding a giant upside-down pyramid in his palm by its pointy tip. "I'm always looking up, trying to balance it," he says. "Are there too many people on this side or that side? In my job, I do two things fundamentally, artist management and cost control. Both depend on hundreds of interactions that are happening above me up in the fat end of the pyramid. And I have to be okay with the fact that I don't understand a freaking thing that's going on half the time. And that is the magic. The trick, always, is keeping the pyramid in balance. So far in this section of the book, I've explored some of the mechanisms we use at Pixar to build and protect our creative culture. I've talked about specific techniques and traditions that broaden our viewpoints, from research trips to Pixar University to the Brain Trust. I've talked somewhat abstractly about the importance of remaining open, not occasionally, but all the time, as a route to self-awareness. Now I want to share some concrete examples of the kinds of mental models I believe are essential to fortify and sustain anyone engaged in the hard work of inventing something new. Let's now examine several of the approaches that my colleagues and I use to keep our doubts at bay as we push toward originality, toward that unmade future. When Brad Bird was directing The Incredibles, he had a recurring anxiety dream. In this dream, he was driving down a winding and precarious stretch of highway in a rickety old station wagon with no one else in the car. Apparently, it was up to him to pilot the vehicle. "But I was in the back seat," he says. "For some reason, I still had a steering wheel, but my visibility was terrible because of where I was sitting. Basically, all I could do is say to myself, 'Don't crash, don't crash, don't crash.'" The takeaway, as he puts it, sometimes as a director, you're driving, and other times, you're letting the car drive. Whenever I hear Brad describe this dream, I'm struck by its familiar themes: blindness, fear of the unknown, helplessness, lack of control. These fears came to him in sleep, but during his waking hours, he sought to master them by rejecting the backseat driver analogy in favor of a different mental model: skiing. Brad has told me that he thinks of directing the way he thinks about skiing. In either pursuit, he says, if he tightens up or thinks too much, he crashes. There are moments as a director where there is so much work to do and so little time to do it that he can't help but feel fear. But he also knows that if he lingers too long in that frightened place, he will freak out. So I tell myself that I have time even when I don't, as in, okay, I'm going to proceed as if I have time. I'm going to sit back and muse rather than looking at the clock, because if I sit back and muse, I'm more likely to solve the problem. This is where directing is a lot like skiing. "I like to go fast," Brad says before launching into a story about a trip he took to Vail when, in the course of a week, I cracked the lens of my goggles 4 times. 4 times I had to go to the ski store and say, "I need a new piece of plastic," because I had shattered it crashing into something. And at some point, I realized that I was crashing because I was trying so hard not to crash. So I relaxed and told myself, "It's going to be scary when I make the turns really fast, but I'm going to push that mountain away and enjoy it." When I adopted this positive attitude, I stopped crashing. In some ways, it's probably like an Olympic athlete who spent years training for one moment when they can't make a mistake. If they start thinking too much about that, they'll be unable to do what they know how to do. Athletes and musicians often refer to being in the zone, that mystical place where their inner critic is silenced and they completely inhabit the moment, where the thinking is clear and the motions are precise. Often, mental models help get them there. Just as George Lucas liked to imagine his company as a wagon train headed west, its passengers full of purpose, part of a team, unwavering in their pursuit of their destination, the coping mechanisms used by Pixar and Disney Animation's directors, producers, and writers draw heavily on visualization. By imagining their problems as familiar pictures, They are able to keep their wits about them when the pressures of not knowing shake their confidence. Byron Howard, one of our directors at Disney, told me that when he was learning to play the guitar, a teacher taught him the phrase, "If you think, you stink." The idea resonated with him, and it informs his work as a director to this day. The goal is to get so comfortable and relaxed with your instrument or process that you can just get zen with it and let the music flow without thinking, he told me. I notice the same thing when I storyboard. I do my best work when I'm zipping through the scene, not overthinking, not worrying if every drawing is perfect, but just flowing with and connecting to the scene, sort of doing it by the seat of my pants. I'm particularly struck by Byron's focus on speed, on zipping through complex problems of logic and storytelling, because it reminds me of what Andrew Stanton says about being a director. I've told you about Andrew's belief that we will all be happier and more productive if we hurry up and fail. For him, moving quickly is a plus because it prevents him from getting stuck worrying about whether his chosen course of action is the wrong one. Instead, he favors being decisive, then forgiving yourself if your initial decision proves misguided. Andrew likens the director's job to that of a ship captain out in the middle of the ocean, with a crew that's depending on him to make land. The director's job is to say, "Land is that way." Maybe land actually is that way, and maybe it isn't. But Andrew says that if you don't have somebody choosing a course, pointing their finger toward that spot there on the horizon, then the ship goes nowhere. It's not a tragedy if the leader changes her mind later and says, "Okay, it's actually not that way, it's this way. I was wrong." As long as you commit to a destination and drive toward it with all your might, people will accept when you correct course. People want decisiveness, but they also want honesty about when you've effed up, as Andrew says. It's a huge lesson. Include people in your problems, not just your solutions. This is key to an idea I introduced earlier in the book. The director or leader can never lose the confidence of his or her crew. As long as you have been candid and had good reasons for making your, now flawed in retrospect, decisions, your crew will keep rowing. But if you find that the ship is just spinning around, and if you assert that such meaningless activity is in fact forward motion, then the crew will balk. They know better than anyone when they are working hard but not going anywhere. People want their leaders to be confident. Andrew doesn't advise being confident merely for confidence' sake. He believes that leadership is about making your best guess and hurrying up about it so if it's wrong, there's still time to change course. There's something else, too. If you're going to undertake a creative project that requires working closely with other people, you must accept that collaboration brings complications. Other people have so much to recommend them. They will help you see outside yourself. They will rally when you are flagging. They will offer ideas that push you to be better. But they will also require constant interaction and communication. Other people are your allies, in other words. But that alliance takes sustained effort to build, and you should be prepared for that, not irritated by it. As Andrew says, continuing his nautical metaphor, if you're sailing across the ocean and your goal is to avoid weather and waves, then why the hell are you sailing, he says. You have to embrace that sailing means that you can't control the elements and that there will be good days and bad days and that whatever comes, you will deal with it because your goal is to eventually get to the other side. You will not be able to control exactly how you get across. That's the game you decided to be in. If your goal is to make it easier and simpler, then don't get in the boat. Andrew's mental model addresses the fear that inevitably comes when your boat is tossed by a storm or stalls for lack of wind. If one looks at creativity as a resource that we continually draw upon to make something from nothing, then our fear stems from the need to make the non-existent come into being. As we've discussed, people often try to overcome this fear by simply repeating what has worked in the past. That leads nowhere. Or more accurately, it leads in the opposite direction of originality. The trick is to use our skills and knowledge not to duplicate, but to invent. In talking to directors and writers, I'm constantly inspired by the models they keep in their heads. Each a unique mechanism they use to keep moving forward through adversity in pursuit of their goals. Pete Docter compares directing to running through a long tunnel, having no idea how long it will last, but trusting that he will eventually come out intact at the other end. There's a really scary point in the middle where it's just dark, he says. There's no light from where you came in, and there's no light at the other end. All you can do is keep going. And then you start to see a little light, and then a little more light, and then suddenly you're out in the bright sun. For Pete, this metaphor is a way of making that moment, the one in which you can't see your own hand in front of your face, and you aren't sure you'll ever find your way out, a bit less frightening. Because your rational mind knows that tunnels have two ends, your emotional mind can be kept in check when pitch blackness descends in the confusing middle. Instead of collapsing into a nervous mess, the director, who has a clear internal model of what creativity is and the discomfort it requires, finds it easier to trust that light will shine again. The key is to never stop moving forward. Rich Moore, who directed Wreck-It Ralph for Disney Animation, envisions a slightly different scenario. He imagines himself in a maze while he's making a movie. Instead of running through willy-nilly, frantically searching for his way out, he places the tips of his fingers along one wall as he moves forward, slowing down here and there to assess and using his sense of touch to help him remember the route he's traveled so far. But he keeps moving so as not to panic. I loved mazes as a kid, Rich says, but you have to keep your head to find your way out. When I see a movie go south, I think to myself, well, they went nuts in the maze. They freaked out in there, and it fell apart. Bob Peterson, who has helped solve creative problems on almost every Pixar film, credits Andrew with giving him a model that has been invaluable to his career. On A Bug's Life, Bob says, Andrew compared making a movie to an archaeological dig. This adds yet another element to the picture, the idea that as you progress, your project is revealing itself to you. You're digging away and you don't know what dinosaur you're digging for, Bob says. Then you reveal a little bit of it, and you may be digging in two different places at once, and you think what you have is one thing, but as you go farther and farther blindly digging, it starts revealing itself. Once you start getting a glimpse of it, you know how better to dig. Bob and Andrew have heard me voice my objection to this particular metaphor many times. As I've said, I believe that when we work on a movie, we are not uncovering an existing thing that had the bad luck to get buried under eons of sediment. We are creating something new. But they argue that the idea the movie is in there somewhere, think of David trapped in Michelangelo's block of marble, helps them stay on track and not lose hope. So while I started this chapter by insisting that what moviegoers see on the screen does not emerge fully formed from some visionary's brain, I have to allow for this idea. Having faith that the elements of a movie are all there for us to find often sustains us during the search. If this model resonates with you, just recognize that it has its pitfalls. Even Andrew warns that during your excavation, not every bone you unearth will necessarily belong to the skeleton you are trying to assemble. There may be the bones of several different dinosaurs or stories mixed up in your dig site. The temptation to use everything you find, even if it doesn't fit, is strong. After all, you probably worked hard to dig each element up. But if you were discerning and rigorous in your analysis of each piece, if you compare it to the bits you've found already to see if it's a match, your movie or project will reveal itself to you. After a while, it starts to tell me what's there, Andrew says. That's the place you're looking for, when the movie starts to tell you what it wants to be. Michael Arndt, who wrote Toy Story 3, and I have had an ongoing dialectic about the way he envisions his job. He compares writing a screenplay to climbing a mountain blindfolded. The first trick, he likes to say, is to find the mountain. In other words, you must feel your way, letting the mountain reveal itself to you. And notably, he says, climbing a mountain doesn't necessarily mean ascending. Sometimes you hike up for a while feeling good, only to be forced back down into a crevasse before clawing your way out again. And there is no way of knowing where the crevasses will be. I like a lot about this metaphor, except for its implication that the mountain exists. Like Andrew's archaeological dig, it suggests that the artist must simply find the piece of art or the idea that is hidden from sight. It seems to me to contradict one of my central beliefs, that the future is unmade, and we must create it. If writing a screenplay is like climbing a mountain blindfolded, that implies that the goal is to see an existing mountain, while I believe it should be the goal of creative people to build their own mountain from scratch. But as I've talked to my colleagues who perform a variety of different jobs, I've come to respect that the most important thing about a mental model is that it enables whoever relies on it to get their job, whatever it is, done. The uncreated is a vast empty space. This emptiness is so scary that most hold on to what they know, making minor adjustments to what they understand, unable to move on to something unknown. To enter that place of fear and to fill that empty space, we need all the help we can get. Michael is a screenwriter, which means he starts with a blank page. That requires charting the path from nothing to something, and imagining himself as a blindfolded mountain climber serves him, he says, because it girds him for the inevitable ups and downs of his job. I've now described several models, and the thing I believe they have in common is the search for an unseen destination. For land across the ocean, Andrew. For light at the end of the tunnel, Pete. For a way out of the maze, Rich. For the mountain itself, Michael. This makes sense for creative leaders who must guide so many people through the beats of a story or the production of a film. At the beginning, the director's or writer's destination is unclear, but he or she must forge ahead anyway. Producers, however, have a different, more logistical job. If directors must summon their creative vision, and writers must impose structure and make a story sing, producers are there to keep things real. Their job is to make sure a project stays on track and on budget, so it makes perfect sense that their mental models differ markedly from those of their colleagues. Remember John Walker's upside-down pyramid? His mental model focuses not on climbing a hill or reaching a destination, but on balancing a multitude of competing demands. Other producers have their own ways of imagining their jobs, but 2-1, they have this in common. Managing a multiplicity of forces, not to mention hundreds of people with minds of their own, requires balance. Lindsay Collins, a producer who has worked with Andrew on several films, imagines herself as a chameleon who can change her colors depending on which constituency she's dealing with. The goal is not to be fake or curry favor, but to be whatever person is needed in the moment. In my job, sometimes I'm a leader, sometimes I'm a follower, sometimes I run the room, and sometimes I say nothing and let the room run itself, she says. Adapting to your environment like a lizard that blends into whatever background it finds itself in is Lindsay's way of managing the competing and potentially crazy-making forces she encounters in her job. I'm a firm believer in the chaotic nature of the creative process needing to be chaotic. If we put too much structure on it, we will kill it. So there's a fine balance between providing some structure and safety, financial and emotional, but also letting it get messy and stay messy for a while. To do that, you need to assess each situation to see what's called for, and then you need to become what's called for. How does one make such an assessment? Lindsay jokes that she employs the Columbo effect, a reference to Peter Falk's iconic TV detective who appeared to bumble his way through a case even as he inevitably zeroed in on the culprit. When mediating between two groups who aren't communicating well, for example, Lindsay feigns confusion. You say, "You know, maybe it's just me, but I don't understand. I'm sorry I'm slowing you down here with all my silly questions, but could you just explain to me one more time what that means? Just break it down for me like I'm a 2-year-old. Good producers and good managers don't dictate from on high. They reach out, they listen, they wrangle, coax, and cajole. And their mental models of their jobs reflect that. Catherine Serafian, another Pixar producer, credits the clinical psychologist Tybee Collar with giving her a helpful way of visualizing her role. One of Collar's big teachings is about meeting people where they are, Catherine says, referring to what Collar calls the process communication model, which compares being a manager to taking the elevator from floor to floor in a big building. It makes sense to look at every personality as a condominium, Catherine says. People live on different floors and enjoy different views. Those on the upper floors may sit out on their balconies. Those on the ground floor may lounge on their patios. Regardless, to communicate effectively with them all, you must meet them where they live. The most talented members of Pixar's workforce, whether they're directors, producers, production staff, artists, whatever, are able to take the elevator to whatever floor and meet each person based on what they need in the moment and how they like to communicate. One person may need to spew and vent for 20 minutes about why something doesn't look right before we can move in and focus on the details. Another person may be all about, "I can't make these deadlines unless you give me this particular thing that I need." I always think of my job as moving between floors up and down all day long. When she's not imagining herself in an elevator, Catherine pretends she's a shepherd guiding a flock of sheep. Like Lindsay, she spends some time assessing the situation, figuring out the best way to guide her flock. "I'm going to lose a few sheep over the hill, and I have to collect them," she says. "I'm going to have to run to the front at times, and I'm going to have to stay back at times, and somewhere in the middle of the flock, there's going to be a bunch of stuff going on that I can't even see. And while I'm looking for the sheep that are lost, something else is going to happen that I'm not aiming my attention at. Also, I'm not entirely sure where we're going. Over the hill? Back to the barn? Eventually I know we will get there, but it can be very, very slow. You know, a car crosses the road and the sheep are all in the way. I'm looking at my watch going, 'Oh my God, sheep, move already.' But the sheep are going to move how they move. And we can try to control them as best we can, but what we really want to do is pay attention to the general direction they're heading and try to steer a little bit." Notice how each of these models contains so many of the themes we've talked about so far. The need to keep fear in its place, the need for balance, the need to make decisions, but also to admit fallibility, and the need to feel that progress is being made. What's important, I think, as you construct the mental model that works best for you, is to be thoughtful about the problems it is helping you to solve. I've always been intrigued, for example, by the way that many people use the analogy of a train to describe their companies. Massive and powerful, the train moves inexorably down the track, over mountains and across vast plains, through the densest fog and darkest night. When things go wrong, we talk of getting derailed and of experiencing a train wreck. And I've heard people refer to Pixar's production group as a finely tuned locomotive that they would love the chance to drive. What interests me is the number of people who believe that they have the ability to drive the train and who think that this is the power position, that driving the train is the way to shape their company's futures. The truth is, it's not. Driving the train doesn't set its course. The real job is laying the track. I am constantly rethinking my own models for how to deal with uncertainty and change and how to enable people. At Lucasfilm, I had the image of riding bareback on a herd of wild horses, some of them faster than others, trying to keep steady. Other times, I've imagined my feet on either side of one of those balance boards that moves atop a cylindrical roller. No matter what image I come up with, questions remain. How do we keep from veering too far to one side or another? How do we follow our carefully laid plans yet remain open to ideas that are not our own? Over time, with new experiences, my model has continued to evolve and is still evolving even as I write this book. One model that has been extremely helpful to me I found completely by accident. It came from the study of mindfulness, which has attracted a lot of attention in recent years, both in academia and in business. Those who write about it focus on how it helps people reduce stress in their lives and direct their attention. But for me, it has also helped clarify my thinking about how groups of creative people work best together. Several summers ago, my wife Susan gave me a gift that led to this insight. Sensing that I needed a break, she arranged for me to attend a silent meditation retreat at the Shambhala Mountain Center in Red Feather Lakes, Colorado. The week-long immersion was open to beginners, but of the 70 people there, I was the only one who'd never meditated. For me, the thought of spending several days in silence seemed unimaginable, even weird. I was intrigued and sort of bumbling along when 2 days into it, we went into full silence. I wasn't sure what to do. The voice in my head chattered continuously, and I wasn't sure how to process it. On the third day, with my mind abuzz from all the non-speaking I was doing, I almost bailed out. Most people have heard of the Eastern teaching that it is important to exist in the moment. It can be hard to train yourself to observe what is right now, and not to bog down in thoughts of what was and what will be, but the philosophical teaching that underlies that idea, the reason that staying in the moment is so vital, is equally important. Everything is changing, all the time, and you can't stop it, and your attempts to stop it actually put you in a bad place. It causes pain, but we don't seem to learn from it. Worse than that, resisting change robs you of your beginner's mind, your openness to the new. At the Shambhala Mountain Center that summer, I didn't bail. Even though the terminology was alien to me, it resonated with many of the issues I spent so much time thinking about at Pixar. Control, change, randomness, trust, consequences. The search for a clear mind is one of the fundamental